Hello and welcome to another edition of Running Dialogue, a podcast about movies. My name is Kurt Holman. I'm the film critic and a staff writer of Creative Loafing Atlanta. And with me are my co-hosts.
I'm Matt Goldberg. I'm with Collider.com.
And I'm Russ Fisher from SlashFilm.com.
And not that many films opened this week that we actually saw, the three of us, except for I'm Still Here, which I saw, but Matt and Russ weren't able to. And it's pretty interesting, but I won't get into that too much because they don't want to be spoiled very much. So,
thank you.
But so instead, we're going to talk a little bit about the movies that we're excited about as kind of a fall preview type thing. And I guess we should preclude January from the list, even though Don't Be Afraid of the Dark opens in January, which we're probably all pretty excited about. So,
yeah, I mean, yeah. I'm a friend of mine made Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, so I'm sort of irrationally excited about that.
Just because
I'm happy to see him get his feature debut. But I genuinely really liked the footage, too,
Like,
aside from that. So,
anyway, let's not talk about a movie we're not going to talk about. Instead, talk about ones that we want to.
Yeah.
What are you guys excited about? Yeah.
I would say the films I'm most excited for are Darren Aronofsky's Black Swan, the Coen brothers' True Grit, and Danny Boyle's 127 Hours. I'm really looking forward to those films. But, yeah, I mean, I wrote up a list on Collider about a week ago about, like, the 15 films I was most looking forward to this season. And I mean, there's a good variety. Like, I'm also looking forward to, you know, Tron Legacy and Due Date and films like that. I think there's a good variety this fall. But if someone said, you can only see one film this fall, I'd definitely go with True Grit. But that's because, like, I'm a huge Coen Brothers fan. I think it's got a great cast. It has Jeff Bridges, Matt Damon, Josh Brolin. And it's the Coen brothers doing a Western.
Yeah.
So
I guess Josh Brolin is the bad guy.
He's playing the bad guy.
And was, did Robert Duvall play that character in the first movie or someone, didn't someone famous?
Bloody hell. Give me a second.
Okay. Sorry to mix it up.
But yeah, and it's supposedly a more faithful adaptation of the Charles Portis novel than was the John Wayne movie. And there are things that we don't know, but like early on in the production, Carter Burwell, who scores all of the Coen brothers' movies, was saying that he was talking about using kind of these classic Presbyterian hymns as the basis for the music for the film, which is a really kind of interesting way to anchor it and, again, make it sort of maybe, I don't know, I kind of hate to use the word realistic, but maybe a bit more detail-oriented and specifically period detail-oriented than the original film was, which was a good film, but is certainly like a broader kind of more pulpy, for lack of a better word, movie than I kind of expect this one to be.
Yeah, this is the one where, if people don't know the original, it's where the teenage girl hires a man with True Grit.
Right.
I don't know. I don't know if he's. I assume he's named Rooster Cogburn.
I mean, Rooster's his nickname. He's a U.S. Marshal, and he's kind of drunk and irascible and blah blah blah. And he was John Wayne's character in the original movie, and he won the Oscar for it. And actually, if you have a second, go to YouTube and search John Wayne Oscar True Grit, because his acceptance speech is really moving and really kind of beautiful. It's one of the classic Oscar acceptance speeches. In this film, he's played by Jeff Bridges, which is, I think, going to be, an interesting change of pace.
It also seems almost too good in terms of casting.
Because
It seems like Jeff Bridges seems to be the perfect age to play a role like that.
Right.
You know, so.
But in the original film, sort of, John Wayne became the hero of the movie, whereas in the book, the central character and the hero of the book is really
Maddie Ross.
Mm-hmm. Who is, you know, the young girl, and she's played by a relative newcomer named Haley Steinfeld in this movie.
Right.
Who we have really seen nothing from. We don't know anything about. And that's almost the most exciting part of the film for me, because it's like
they did like a nationwide search for her.
Yeah, absolutely. And if there's one thing the Coens can do really well, and there are actually a number of things that they do really well, but one of the things that they do superlatively is cast. And so if they've decided, hey, this girl is the actress around whom we're going to anchor our new film, I'm thrilled. Like, I want to see her. I want to see who they've chosen and why.
Yeah.
And that's the thing I'm anticipating. It's like them doing a Western, awesome. Them doing True Grit, great. All of them working with, you know, Josh Brolin again, Matt Damon, Jeff Bridges, everybody who's in the movie, fantastic. But I think it's that potential surprise and discovery of a new talent that to me is like the most interesting thing, or the most potentially interesting and certainly exciting thing about it.
I was excited before, but hearing you talk about it, it's like, oh, I'm getting all revved up now.
I'm with Matt. It's like it's one of the movies that I'm really most interested in, and it's a Christmas Day opening, so it's like I'm kind of. That's fun because I'll be in Texas at my parents' place in the middle of the hill country out in the middle of nowhere, and there's like one theater that's 40 miles away, and I think it'll actually be playing True Grit, so I think there's a good chance my parents who actually like Westerns and I can go see True Grit together on...
It'll be the latest like Meet the Fockers movie, in which case...
I really can't do it.
That's I was going to say, or maybe they'll show The Illusionist.
Yeah.
Probably not as wide a release, but...
Exactly. Hey, The Illusionist, you know, the new movie by the guy who did The Triplets of Belleville, and based on a scenario by Jacques Tati, who's an amazing French director who did these really wonderful kind of sort of post Chaplin-esque kind of modern life comedies, and that's a terrible way to describe his movies. I'm sorry, but it's like his story is the basis for The Illusionist, and his on-screen character in his own movies is the basis for the main character, The Illusionist, and it's a beautiful-looking movie. So, I want to see that, too.
Yeah. Since we mentioned Jeff Bridges, I don't know how high Tron Legacy is on our list, but since he plays what appear to be two roles in it, maybe we should mention Tron Legacy now.
Legacy is interesting because he is technically playing two roles. He's playing the old Kevin Flynn, who in the film has been missing for, I think, over 20 years.
Since 1982, I guess.
Since the first movie.
Or a little bit after, because he has a son, and the point is that his son, who's played by Garrett Hedlund, is searching for him. And so Kevin Flynn has been missing, and apparently he's in the world of Tron. But he also has his avatar, Clue.
CLU.
CLU. And he's also in that, but it's a younger Jeff Bridges, and they've tried this sort of, we're going to.
It looks like Clue is the bad guy, and from what I might not be like this, but the trailer makes it like that the kind of the real Jeff Bridges is older and maybe not imprisoned, but seems like that the son has to kind of try and go on this quest to find his dad, and the younger Clue is kind of trying as an adversary. At least that seems like how it sets it up.
I'm just really impressed with Well, obviously, it's a cool-looking film, but the effects they've been able to pull off making that younger-looking Jeff Bridges, because we've seen those kind of effects before, and they don't really work that well, but I've been pretty damn convinced looking at Clue and saying, holy shit, they found young Jeff Bridges.
The visual design of that movie is phenomenal. I love it. And it's like Tron was one of those movies, I was, 9 or 10 when it came out. And even then, I was like, I think I like Tron more now than I did then because I look at it and it's sort of, this kind of forward-thinking attempt on Disney's part to actually kind of leapfrog ahead of the Star Wars movies in a way in terms of putting together this science fiction, would-be blockbuster. And it kind of doesn't work, but it tried all of these things that I think are great and that I respect it for doing. And Tron Legacy carries forward that visual design in a way that's really, really cool. And it's got music by Daft Punk, not my favorite duo or anything, but at the same time, such a perfect choice for that. For this thing, like to score a movie that takes place inside a computer, you get the French DJ duo who perform with robot masks, and whose music is sort of.
We really wanted the robots, but we'll take Daft Punk.
Exactly, I think they're actually in the movie, and there's all this stuff, and it's like I think I'm more excited about the soundtrack for the film than I am for the film itself, and the reason being that they've done a couple of reshoots on the movie, and everything that I hear is that they're doing the reshoots to try to minimize the presence of Garrett Hedlund, who is supposedly really not very good. And so it's sort of like, okay, we'll see. I hope that's not the case. I hope that, he's better than I've been told. And I'm certainly interested in the movie. I mean, I'm going to be there minute one, if only for all of these other elements. And Bridges.
I've been kind of baffled a little bit by kind of like this, the Tron nostalgia. And to me, it's almost like nostalgia for things like the Goonies, you know, where
I think
it's like driven by people who are like obviously younger than me,
right,
who maybe have been like, you know, kids and connected with these in a way that since I was like a teenager or like in my early 20s when some of these movies came out, you know, it was like someone like, it's all right, you know.
And kind of connected, people who connected with the Goonies maybe like on cable or VHS or yeah. You know, whatever, that sort of thing. Because, yeah, I saw that movie opening weekend, and I liked it,
yeah. But
I wasn't, you know.
Yeah, it's not something I'm going to get a Goonies tattoo or...
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I can't wait for, like, the new, you know, I get Never Say Die, you know, scroll across my forehead.
And,
yeah. You know, it's a, you should do that.
I should do that anyway.
They're great. Look for you. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I think they're fun adventure films, but, again, I'm not one of those... I mean, there are people that go nuts for the Goonies. In fact, I think it's part of this... there's this art show at Gallery 1988. Right?
Oh, right, yeah.
For it's called 3G, and there's Goonies, Gremlins, and Ghostbusters, and artists doing their takes on all three films.
Well, what we're kind of seeing is that there's this wave of actors and comedians and filmmakers who are, you know, my age or, you know, which is late 30s or a little younger or older, and all of whom seem to be kind of collectively trying to channel that early to mid-80s Amblin Entertainment vibe.
Yeah.
You know, which was the sort of Spielberg run and influenced company that produced a lot of the, you know, generated the sort of character of films like Back to the Future and Goonies and, you know, certainly crossed over into Gremlins and things like that. And it's there was this feeling to those films and the way that they approached kind of adventure stories and genre and character and comedy. And people seem to be very deliberately trying to recapture that now.
Yeah.
And maybe that's just because there's an obvious perceived nostalgia for things like the Goonies. But we're definitely hearing about these films that are like, oh, it's going to really try to capture that Amblin thing. Like, you know, Paul, the Greg Mottola directed thing with Simon Pegg and Nick Frost.
Super 8.
Super 8, yes. the J.J. Abrams.
Put it by name and Spielberg is producing.
Exactly, yeah. Movies like that where they're like, yeah, we're really trying for the Amblin thing, you know. And even like the Fright Night remake, which is currently shooting, you know, has referenced that and things along those lines.
Yeah.
So that's kind of an interesting thing that's you know, okay, 20 years later, 30 years later, whatever, this is kind of all coming back around.
It's almost like it's what happens to have been popular with a group of people who are now of an age, you know. So it's almost like the content is kind of like not irrelevant, but, you know, it's not necessarily the most important thing,
right.
But
I guess this is the equivalent of like making the Big Chill for baby boomers.
Well, maybe, but it's funny. It's like, you know, it's like I was like 10 when Jaws came out and 12 when Star Wars came out. So people my age, you know, kind of flash back on those.
Right.
But this is almost like people are excited about like the Apple Dumpling Gang or, you know, the world's greatest athlete, you know.
Right.
It's like, so I don't quite get it 100%.
Right.
But to get back kind of to the point of this show, Tron Legacy almost seems like the closest we have this fall to Avatar.
Yeah, you know, certainly. So,
yeah, it's the big action film of the season.
And kind of the technological pushing one. So
It's almost alone in that respect. It's like there are certainly a couple of other big kind of effects-based movies that are coming out in December, like Gulliver's Travels and Yogi Bear, but those look utterly horrible.
Yeah.
and I can't understand why anyone would want to see them. I mean, Yogi Bear, whatever, if you're six, you want to see it, and that's fine.
If you're six, you'd want to see shiny objects.
That's great. Make movies for six-year-olds. That's fine.
Yeah.
Ideally, make them for six-year-olds and the, you know, parents that have to take them. But, you know, okay. Yogi Bear, it's for a certain audience. But, like, Gulliver's Travels.
There is one other big action film coming out, and I totally forgot until I looked at Kurt has a copy of Entertainment Weekly.
I love you, Philip Morris.
Yeah. I love you, Philip Morris. That one has the action.
The gay love story with Ewan McGregor and
Jim Carrey.
Yeah. Okay, that one I'm looking forward to.
Yeah.
But Kurt has a copy of Entertainment Weekly on the desk with Harry Potter on it.
Yeah. I do have like real high hopes for Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows 1 because the last book has been famously split into two movies.
Right.
It seems kind of confusing as to where the split is. Well, I guess the confusing thing is like it's almost like, so will this be like a 2.5 hour movie and the other will be like a less than 90 minute movie? Because it's like two thirds through the book.
Right.
The book this part of the book, you know, not to get into too many details, but it's very much kind of a fugitive story with Harry, Hermione, and Ron kind of on the run as the forces of Voldemort are kind of in ascendance. And it's pretty grim stuff as far as, like, being intense. It's like they're, like, behind enemy lines with the wizarding world turned against them almost. So, you know, I mean, and I think it could be really cool as this kind of paranoid adventure with, you know, magic wands and stuff like that, and big snakes, you know. Yeah.
Well, it's also, and I mean, it's also challenging because it's the only one of the books that doesn't take place in Hogwarts. Mm-hmm. You know, the first, like, do have that structure. You know, Harry goes through the school year, meets new professors, and you know, grows and learns and loves. This is completely outside the bounds, and it's really that it is a chaotic time, and it's meant to sort of mirror, you know, I think when Rowling wrote it, to sort of mirror the experience of someone who is out of school and trying to learn life without that structure and how scary that it can be. Obviously, we usually don't have dark wizards hunting us, but you never know. But I think it will be interesting to see how they split it, because I don't think – well, I think maybe – Book 5 could have been split, or Book 4. In fact, I think Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, in terms of the book, is the longest book there is. Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows is a long book, but a lot of it is just them in the woods running. It's not exactly a plot-intensive book in terms of what actually happens.
It has a lot of high scenes, and they're trying to find these, you know, magical MacGuffins
that will help them defeat Voldemort. It's not, I don't want to say, like, oh, it's boring, but it's definitely more... if you could take things in there and easily condense them down into montages, and it's interesting that they've actually split this up. So I'm curious as well to see, you know, each Harry Potter film, I think, has been like almost, you know, they've been getting longer, and that makes sense as the books are longer as well. But will this one be 2.5 hours and then the next one be 90 minutes?
Yeah.
I mean, the split has got to be a purely financial decision on the part.
Oh, it is.
Well, that's absolutely.
You know, it's just, my God, our keystone – ultra reliable franchises ending. What do we do? And, you know, same thing as, you know, obviously it inspired Summit to split the last Twilight film into two films.
Which seems like, you know, based on like the Matrix and the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, did not seem to have very good creative, you know.
But I would say the difference is that neither of those are based off pre-existing material.
Right.
Like both Twilight and Harry Potter are pre-sold. They know that that audience is there and has already bought it, and they're going to see that movie.
Yeah.
Whereas Pirates and the Matrix sequels were sort of, oh, we had a really good one, now let's make two sequels back to back.
Yeah,
right.
You know, to seize on this. Excitement.
Well, the Pirates movies were financially successful, but I didn't particularly like them very much as movies.
Well, the problem with the second and third Pirates films is that they were both written on the fly. I mean, both of those sequels went into production without a finished script, and I think the third one went into production with like an outline. I mean, the movies were not written; they were written as they went along, and you can tell.
Yeah,
you know, they're very.
I still have a lot of fun with them, though.
I like the first one. The first Pirates of the Caribbean.
I love the first one.
I rewatched not long ago. I think after seeing Prince of Persia. Which just felt like
the palette.
It just felt like a Pirates clone, like a wannabe. So I was like, I wonder if Pirates still holds up. Hey, it does. Great. But the second and third movies, I just can't bear to watch. And in different reasons that are totally different from the way that I can't bear to watch the second and third Matrix movies.
Yeah.
But anyway, to go back on, on track.
Back to the fall.
You know, I don't know. I mean, there are a lot of other really potentially interesting movies that are coming up. I mean, you know, there's David Fincher's The Social Network, which is his allegedly somewhat fictionalized account of the founding of Facebook, with Jesse Eisenberg and Justin Timberlake and Andrew Garfield, who's the guy playing the new Spider-Man. And it's like the trailers, the main trailer for that film was fantastic.
It's like one of the best films of the year so far is the trailer for The Social Network.
It's an astoundingly well-cut trailer. I mean, they did a beautiful job with it, and I've heard really good things about the script and reportedly,
Aaron Sorkin, right?
Yeah.
Aaron Sorkin handled the script.
Yeah, Sorkin wrote it and...
of The West Wing and stuff like that. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's like supposedly Andrew Garfield got cast in Spider-Man on the basis of... you know, his work in The Social Network. And I'm really curious because it's a film where, you know, the film was announced and it was sort of like, ha-ha, the Facebook movie. Well, okay, I guess there's kind of a story there.
And then it was, well, it's, and it's based off a book called The Accidental Billionaires, which, you know, so in terms of just doing something from scratch, the whole outline and the writer, Ben Mesrick, he found the drama there in terms of basic. What'll be interesting is sort of taking, you know, Mark Zuckerberg's character. Because Zuckerberg was not interviewed for the book because he was asked repeatedly, you know, please let me interview you. So everyone else involved was interviewed except for Zuckerberg.
Yeah.
So
he's sort of an key guy.
Like, so he's sort of an enigmatic figure, but at the same time, he's very fascinating. I read the book, and the thing that really jumped out at me is that in basically 2001, Zuckerberg invented what we now know as the genius function on iTunes. And Microsoft tried to buy it from him for like $1 million, and he said no. Because he didn't care. Like, his whole idea is like, I just want to prove that I can do something. And so I think that's definitely an interesting launching point for a character, someone who's not necessarily in it for money, but to show off and like what, you know, lead someone to do those kind of things.
Right.
And David Fincher seems to be a really good, interesting choice for it, because when he's on his game, he's so good at conveying a density of information, and Facebook and the internet, you know, gestalt lends itself to that so much. So, you know.
Well, it's to some extent, I mean, that whole what we know as the internet now is not to say based on, you know, a movie like Fight Club, but it's certainly, you know, they're symbiotically related and they're very similar things. And, you know, David Fincher kind of came of age as a director right as the sort of the information age as we know it was developing and is becoming what it is now. And they're very much, he's very much a part of that. So he, you know, which is probably drawing too close a link between him and the material. But like you said, I think he's sort of eerily appropriate for it.
I do want to jump back a bit and say to Tron Legacy briefly, just to say that I think part of the appeal of Tron now might be just because we're in such an internet saturated society now that it seems appropriate, you know.
Are you thinking of that South Park episode?
Yeah, that too. Yeah, I just watched the South Park Facebook episode where he gets sucked into Facebook like Tron, and it's hilarious, you know. But it's almost like, and because computer animation is so sophisticated and omnipresent, you know, it's almost like the. It's almost more appropriate for there to be a Tron movie now than there was in 1982. You know?
Right.
So, but anyway, we can't spend the whole time talking about a movie that we haven't seen. You know? One thing that's sort of funny about some of the movies coming out is the movies like varying degrees of presumed quality of heroes who are like in these weird physical constraints. Mm-hmm. Like Danny Boyle, who did Slumdog Millionaire, is doing 127 hours with James Franco about this kind of athlete guy who gets like trapped in a crevice with his arm under a boulder, and he goes to extreme lengths basically to get out from under the boulder, basically. So it's like that guy, there's a buried with Ryan Reynolds buried in a coffin alive.
Right.
And is it shot entirely like on his camera phone, basically? Or how do they?
It's basically, it almost entirely takes place within the coffin.
Yeah. So
he's got a cell phone and a lighter.
Yeah.
And
that's,
you know,
about it.
And he brought his itty bitty book light with
exactly.
him. So,
yeah.
And kind of the least of these is presumably is going to be Devil, based on the M. Night Shyamalan thing about these people stuck in an elevator. And Devil looks like one of those Ghost House 8 movies to die for, straight to video things. Right. So it's like, really, this is coming out in theaters, you know? But
I don't know. I like the premise and the look. And I think people would be excited for it if they had no idea that M. Night Shyamalan was involved with it. And I think his name, in fact, I know his name turns people off because I've seen every time I've seen the trailer play in front of a movie, people boo.
If you ever see, I mean, that happened to me once. I it came on and I said this person next to me, people are going to start laughing or booing in a few minutes. And she said, really? Why? You'll see.
Just wait.
Based on an idea of anime, it's like, wah ha ha, boo.
You lose the entire theater. And there, I don't know. There are a few other. There are actually, this fall is actually sort of packed with things, you know, and some weird stuff. Like there's what a woman, a gun, and a noodle shop. And, you know, we're talking about the Coen Brothers and True Grit earlier, and that is Zhang Yimou's remake of the Coen Brothers' debut film Blood Simple, set in feudal China.
Yeah,
and it's but similarly toned in terms of a mix of violence and comedy, and like that looks really intriguing.
Yeah, I love some of Zhang Yimou's films, especially he did a film noir with not that similar to Blood Simple, but kind of it seemed like of the same generation kind of thing called Judo.
Yeah,
that was set in a paint factory, so
maybe
it's like these red paint, so it's like gallons of blood-looking stuff, you know, and it has a story that's kind of like The Postman Always Rings Twice. But I've heard that they're like crazy things about a woman, a gun, and a noodle shop with like cross-dressing and kind of hip-hop type musical numbers.
I hope so.
This could be like great, or it could be really off-puttingly weird. And I really hope it's. I really want to speak.
I don't know that we're going to do movie picks this week, but if we were, this would be the reason that I would say find a DVD copy of the movie Zatoichi by Takeshi Kitano, the Japanese director who typically does gangster movies. Mm-hmm. And Zatoichi was the series of several dozen Japanese samurai movies, essentially. Mm-hmm. Not quite samurai movies, but they're movies about a blind masseuse who's also a master swordsman. Mm-hmm. And it's this great series of, sort of swordplay adventure movies. Yeah. And they were all starring one guy, Shintaro Katsu, and he died, and eventually Takeshi Kitano was convinced to revive the character. Mm-hmm. And his film, Zatoichi, is as much kind of a commentary upon adventure movies and samurai movies, and also has cross-dressing and dance numbers and things like that. Entirely unique. Mm-hmm. And I love Kitano's Zatoichi. I think it's a really, really entertaining, weird, kind of fantastic film. And so if A Woman, A Gun, A Noodle Shop ends up being anything like that, I think I'll be tremendously excited.
Yeah.
We've also got stuff like Let Me In, which is the remake of, or the, not remake, but
re-adaptation.
But the re-adaptation of the novel Let the Right One In, which spawned the Swedish film of the same name. This one is directed by Matt Reeves, the guy who did Cloverfield, and it stars Chloe Moritz, who was in 500 Days of Summer and was Hit Girl in Kick-Ass, and Cody Smith McPhee, who was the young boy in The Road, and Richard Jenkins and Elias Koteas. And it was one of those movies where it was announced, and everybody was like, basically had the same reaction as seeing M. Night Shyamalan's name on the Devil trailer. But then as trailers have come out and as footage was shown at Comic-Con, some of which is now available online, officially released.
As words leaked out from test screening.
You know, it's like, it actually looks pretty damn good. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's certainly well cast. Just having Jenkins as the, you know, if you didn't see Let the Right One In, see it because it's great.
Yeah.
But basically, it's about a young boy who's sort of picked on and runty, and he befriends his new neighbor, who turns out to be kind of vampirically inclined. Mm-hmm. She's taken care of by a caretaker who's played by Richard Jenkins in the new version, and there's, you know, other things going on. And so, like, having Richard Jenkins cast the caretaker is magnificent. Mm-hmm. Having Elias Koteas as the cop who's sort of trying to figure out what's going on is also wonderful as far as I'm concerned. And I love the footage. And that looks like that went from a movie I was sort of completely scornful and skeptical of to being one that I'm really anticipating.
Likewise.
Yeah. It's funny. You mentioned that to the horror thing. I'm really excited about this movie called Monsters.
Yeah, where, absolutely.
I think that there's going to be a screening next week in Atlanta. And it was made for like $15,000, allegedly. And if I understand the plot properly, it's like these aliens have landed and kind of occupied part of Mexico. So there are these things running around. And it's like this kind of quarantined area. And one can read various, like, you know, immigration metaphors into this, I'm sure. But it's mostly about, like, this man and woman have to kind of, like, cross from, like, one end of it to another. And supposedly it's more about their relationship and this kind of this road story.
Yeah.
and they're monsters. Right. You know? Right. And supposedly people who have seen it have really liked it. And so it's like okay, I'm on board with this, you know.
Yeah, I'm excited.
I mean, the name Monsters alone, I'm like, oh, I hope it's a good monster movie, you know. Yeah. So, yeah. And since it's supposed to be good, it's like all the better, you know.
Yeah, I haven't watched the trailers because I'm trying to retain whatever surprise it has to offer. But I've been told very good things. I've spoken to probably a dozen people who've seen it, and they all liked it, which, you know, doesn't necessarily mean anything. But yeah. I'm anticipating it. That's one of those kind of little indies that I'm definitely really keen on.
Yeah.
And, I'm very much looking forward to that screening. I hope it works.
I think before we started recording, you were talking about how much you're excited about Black Swan.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Black Swan is
more of a psychological thriller.
Yeah, it's the new film from Darren Aronofsky, who's the guy who directed The Fountain and The Wrestler, Pi, and Requiem for a Dream, which incidentally I really didn't like. Mm-hmm. But it stars Natalie Portman as a dancer who's trying to win sort of the lead role in a performance of Swan Lake, and she's sort of facing a rival played by Mila Kunis, and her instructor is played by Vincent Cassell. Mm-hmm. And you say all that, and it's like, it sounds stupid and boring. But it's kind of this psychological thriller that's been compared to movies from Roman Polanski, like The Tenant and Rosemary's Baby, both of which are among my favorite films. I mean, The Tenant is one of my five favorite movies of all time. I adore it utterly to death. I think it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And the trailer for Black Swan hit, and it's sort of like there was this collective intake of breath, like, okay, that's what this is about.
You get it conveys a sense of this personality being fragmented going through all this weird stuff. So I hope it's not one of the things like where it's like, hey, Mila Kunis actually doesn't exist, you know, or
it's hard to say,
make a cheap thing like that, you know. But
right. There's some interesting potential plot twists that I've heard rumblings of that I just won't spoil. But, you know, you kind of hear the dance angle and you're like, whatever.
See, I think that's pretty interesting. I like that. I mean, it's like I'm going to make a thriller set in the world of ballet. And I'm like, well, I don't see.
Well, it's like, when you see that it's a thriller and when you see that it's about these personalities really clashing in a certain way, that is certainly, you know, more interesting. So, definitely. But go on. I mean,
Well, it's funny. Aronofsky apparently said that it was like he thought of it as a companion to The Wrestler,
right.
Which seem like kind of opposite. But when you think about, like, I guess wrestling, you know, professional wrestling that's not actually real versus dance, and they both have their own kind of choreography and these kind of ideals of, you know, female and masculine physicality. It's like, you know, it's like, oh, okay, I can see that.
Absolutely.
You know,
so,
Well, it's funny. There's in thinking about like the movies coming out this fall, it struck me that I didn't see a ton of like kind of the old school Oscar movie like period epics and things like that. You know, which is kind of like just as well, I guess, because you know they're expensive and they don't win Oscars that much anymore. You know, it's kind of surprised me though, because it's like, where are the big movies? It's like I'm excited about a lot of these, but in kind of this more. I'm not really expecting, like, a spectacle from them, you know. It's kind of more of the intimate character-based thing, which tend to be the better movies, you know.
But. Well, I guess, the whole, you know, producing a spectacle for the most part requires a big studio backing. And the studios aren't making those movies anymore. Yeah. They're making – the spectacles that they're making are the big summer movies, the glut of which we've just – barely escaped. And I mean, the big spectacle movie now is Tron Legacy. You know, that's what we get instead of a big period epic or something. And it's interesting. There was a piece that I read yesterday by Scott Mendelson, who was saying that it was sort of commenting on the summer movie season, about which I don't really think we need to say a whole lot more. Yeah. But the interesting point that he made was that, you know, as the summer went on, everybody was sort of highlighting you know, how good a lot of the indies were, like Winter's Bone and Exit Through the Gift Shop and The Kids Are All Right and Solitary Man, Get Low, movies like this that were actually really satisfying as movies in the midst of most of the shit that we waded through. And his Mendelsohn's point is that 10 years ago, those would have been studio movies. Mm-hmm. You know, that they wouldn't have been relegated to indies. That they're actually – that it's only in the landscape as it is now that they look like these weird kind of left-of-center movies. Whereas, you know, you look at it, it's like Winter's Bone, okay, not a star cast, but it's – you know, a small thriller that is based around a really simple concept. You know, it's not an esoteric movie by any stretch of the imagination.
No, it's straightforward, and it has kind of a I was going to say a skeleton, but that would sound too punny. You know, it kind of plays a little bit on like a traditional detective story kind of tradition.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, it's a very approachable movie. Mm-hmm. It's not like it's not this super obscure thing. Mm-hmm. You know, Get Low. It's got two people that 10 years ago were stars and should still be stars. Mm-hmm. It's got Robert Duvall and Bill Murray. Mm-hmm. And again, it's this kind of like really engaging drama with big comedic overtones that really works very well. It's like it's not a weird, difficult movie to grasp.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, all of these sort of things. And once upon a time, studios would have made those movies and they would have been packaged up there right alongside all of the other big crap that we've been sent.
Although what's interesting is, you know, you mentioned, you know, these films that are, you know, actually pretty easy to explain. Mm-hmm. And yet the film that won the weekend last weekend was The American, which I think is a very difficult film to explain. I mean, not maybe necessarily in terms of plot, but people like are asking me like, oh, what should I go see? And I say The American, but you know, it's a film that doesn't really try to engage you.
It's
hard to explain why it's compelling.
Yeah,
you know?
In the length of a tweet, you know, to make people want to see it.
Right.
Know? Yeah. Yeah, people might not want to see it, you know. If they're expecting, you know, Ocean's 11, and it's like, so you're just going to make this gun for 5 minutes, you know, even though if you approach it the right way, the gun-making scenes are engrossing, you know.
So. Exactly. So it's sort of it's interesting, you know, that you bring that up about sort of, you know, what's accessible and what's not. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that sort of the film that got – you know, I would say is in no way accessible except for, you know, people want to see George Clooney,
right,
is The American, and that people went to go see it. Whether they liked it, I'm not really sure, I hope they did.
I guess the studios are making things like the sort of semi-upper level romantic comedy type things like James L. Brooks' How Do You Know? And whoever's made like Love and Other Drugs, the kind of the Viagra-related thing with like Jake Gyllenhaal. And, I mean, it's like I can't say I'm excited about those, you know, because, you know, it's like, well, those usually the trailers are all kind of the same for those all the time. And sometimes they're like really good and sometimes they're not good at all. But I just feel like the need to mention that these movies are coming out,
right,
you know,
right,
and that some of them might be decent, you know.
It almost seems like what you get as far as these sort of quote unquote adult drama from studios now are those more middle of the road pictures that are more easily packaged, that are more easily sold to a wide variety of territories and to airlines and cable and, you know, things that are not terribly expensive and are basically guaranteed to make money because you don't have to spend that much promoting them, and they're really easily to sell out as part of packages, content packages to other, you know, platforms. So suddenly they just look financially responsible. So okay, we'll do that.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, Get Low or Winter's Bone or whatever, not so much. Let somebody else take a chance on that.
Yeah. Have we heard anything about things like The Town or The Next 3 Days? Next 3 Days, like Russell Crowe movie with
very positive things about The Town. It just screened at Venice and Toronto, and apparently the word out of it is people like it. That it's a good little thriller and good performances, and Ben Affleck's directed another good movie.
Yeah, I mean The Town is Ben Affleck directing. Himself and Jeremy Renner and
Chris Cooper and John Hamm.
Right, yeah, Hamm is an FBI
agent. Rebecca Hall. Yeah.
Rebecca Hall, yeah, and it's basically like
in your old neighborhood.
Yeah, yes. I never lived in Charlestown, but it takes place pretty much in Charlestown, which is a neighborhood just sort of north and a slight bit west of downtown Boston.
Is it known as the bank robbery capital of the world?
It's It's old school.
Okay.
Yeah.
He's not saying that how they refer to themselves, like at the Board of Tourism in Charlestown.
No, I mean, it's like, yeah, Charlestown is it's a really cool place because it's this sort of very insular. It's almost an island, you know. It's like it's kind of separated by mostly by the Charles River, and it's, you know, you can cross a little bridge from the north end in Boston over to Charlestown, or there are a couple of other ways to get into it. But like I used to when I was in movie production, I used to work with a guy whose prop warehouse was in Charlestown, so I was in there all the time on the north side of the neighborhood. And yeah, I mean, it's this little, it's weird because there's a lot of sort of gentrified new construction on it, and people who work downtown in Boston live there because you just walk over a bridge and you're right there.
Yeah. But he's not saying it's not the bank robbery capital.
But at the same time, yeah, it is. It's kind of this old, you know, there's a definite, or at the time when I was there, which was, you know, 10 years ago, there was a definite separation between certain, you know, groups of residents. And yeah, it's not quite like Providence in terms of being, you know, super crime city, but it's, you know, it's, yeah, you get the sense that stuff happens there. So yeah, Affleck and Renner play, you know, members of this robbery crew, and they pull this bank job, and John Hamm is after them, and there are other complications. And yeah, I loved the trailer, and I loved Ben Affleck's first directorial movie, Gone Baby Gone, also set in Boston. And then, yeah, the next 3 days, which is the Paul Haggis
that
movie.
That one I'm not looking forward to.
Yeah, Russell Crowe. I'm
like, Russell Crowe's wife gets convicted of murder, I think, for, and is supposedly unfairly, and he decides to break her out of jail.
Right.
So it's like, I mean, if you like seeing like the anguished Russell Crowe, this is like
There's another kind of Russell Crowe.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, totally.
So, yeah.
I'm just not a bit. I mean, I'm not even necessarily like an anti-Russell Crowe guy. Mm-hmm. I think he can give a good performance. Mm-hmm. It's just that I'm not a big fan of Paul Haggis. Mm-hmm. I think Crash is crap.
Yeah.
And I mean,
In the Valley of Ella wasn't bad.
It's, really? It's, I think In the Valley of Ella is I mean, America's in Distress, the end. I don't think that's a particularly good film either. Mm-hmm. And although this is a remake, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Okay. Yeah. And I've not seen the original.
Yeah, neither have I. Didn't know the original was any good. But, I mean, I'm not saying it's going to be a terrible. I mean, they're definitely far worse looking films. And it could be good, but that's one that's not really, you know, on my must-see list.
Yeah. We were talking about Darren Aronofsky earlier, which would have been the ideal lead-in to talk about The Fighter. Which is a film that stars Mark Wahlberg and Christian Bale, and was, for a couple of years, was set to be directed by Darren Aronofsky. And it's about two real-life brothers, both of whom were boxers, one of whom, the Christian Bale character, had kind of this criminal, druggy past. And actually, the real guy that is played by Christian Bale was prominently featured in the HBO documentary, was it High on Crack Street, which was about, you know, basically cracked out, sort of this handful of little cracked out group of people that were living in Lowell, Massachusetts. So, you know, it's not quite a Boston movie. Because
Boston is a terrible place to
live.
Crack
that
is the message of bank robberies and crack. That's actually the message of this fall summer.
But didn't David O. Russell end up directing it? That's like basically his first film since, I guess, I Heart Huckabee.
Right. Well, he had this film he was trying to follow up with called Nailed, which was this satire. Mm-hmm. And it was basically, the producer on it was basically a crook, and it never got to the end of its financing. And it's about like, what, 90%? I think it's like
everything in Nailed is entirely shot
except for the crucial scene.
I mean, the whole conceit of Nailed is that Jessica Biel plays a waitress who gets a nail lodged in her skull and kind of becomes a nymphomaniac, among other things. It goes to Washington, where she encounters a congressman played by Jake Gyllenhaal, and it turns into a satire. And the entire film has been shot except the scene where she gets the nail lodged in her head. Like, that was that was the scene that they had to shoot. And the movie was shut down a bunch of times because David Edelstein, the guy who was financing it, kept not paying people. So SAG shut it down twice, and then IATSE, the technical unit, technical union shut it down a couple of times as well.
And now David O. Russell says he's just given up on it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, supposedly there is the idea to actually shoot that scene and finish the movie, and there's an edit that's assembled without it that was done without the participation of David O. Russell. Mm-hmm. So yeah, Russell has now directed The Fighter, mm-hmm. Which is, again, you know, about these two boxing brothers located in Lowell, Massachusetts. And that looks, you know, we haven't seen that much from it, but it's like the pedigree of it is interesting. It was one of those.
I believe, doesn't Christian Bale become like the trainer of the Mark Wahlberg
Irish
fighter?
Mickey Ward, be a championship boxer.
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly. And so we haven't really seen any footage.
I don't think there's been any trailers.
We've seen some shots from it.
Yeah. But just because of the history of it, I'm really interested in that movie.
And it's also got Amy Adams, who I love. I think she's fantastic. Yeah. So, I mean, that's definitely one to watch.
And that's, I think, a December release at this point. So.
It's funny. I can't think of David O. Russell without flashing to the character who's on Entourage, Mark Wahlberg produces, who is allegedly based on David O. Russell, who's this raging, egomaniacal jerk director, and it's alleged, there's allegedly a connection there, but I don't want to cast aspersions, and I'm excited about the movie too. So,
and it's interesting because in the wake of I Heart Huckabees, mm-hmm. which sort of had this notoriously contentious mm-hmm. production atmosphere, I think that's probably putting it lightly.
Yeah,
and it almost seems like David O. Russell has kind of calmed down a little bit, mm-hmm. and between that and the whole experience of Nailed, where things spun out of control and weren't his fault mm-hmm. at all, it's like I knew people who worked on The Fighter because they were all, it was partially staffed by people, again, that I worked with when I was in production in Massachusetts, and they all had really good things to say about it, everyone that, and they're not people, who
need to,
are going to sugarcoat anything, and they were like, it was great, everything went smooth and whatever, so I sort of wonder if David O. Russell has kind of turned a corner, and I also consequently wonder if that's going to be reflected in the film and in his films going forward, and so for that reason as well, that's another reason to be curious about The Fighter if you've followed his trajectory.
It does seem like the kind of movie, sight unseen, not knowing anything about what it's like as a film, that if it hits like the right way, it can be like $1 Million Baby and Hollywood jumps on it and it becomes this big Oscar film and stuff like that.
But
hopefully it's better than Million Dollar.
Yeah, hopefully better than Million Dollar Baby, though. Yeah. Well, I do want to mention, there's this weird Clint Eastwood film.
Hereafter,
where it's like three stories and Matt Damon talks to ghosts or something like
He's
that.
He's a reluctant psychic.
Yeah.
Instead of like a really proactive psychic.
Yeah, exactly. Clint Eastwood has called it his chick flick.
Yeah.
And I don't know that much about it. And I'm a legacy Eastwood fan. I'm going to see anything the guy makes.
Right.
And I really liked Gran Torino.
I love Gran Torino.
Mostly because he was playing my dad.
Yeah.
And, I can't really summarize Hereafter that well because it's one that I've sort of deliberately kept at arm's length.
It seems like it's a film with like three characters who follows them separately.
And then they're
wind together. So one hopes it's not like, Will Smith 7 pounds, maybe more like a 21 grams, which is a film I like. The divided audiences, I will say,
Not a fan.
Okay. So anyway, I think I was just saying that talking about films that we haven't seen can be more exciting than talking about ones we have because there's all this promise,
Right, exactly.
The reasons why we're excited.
We'll see you at
film.
The end of the year when we've all just are hating everything and are looking forward to the spring season.
Remember how much I wanted to see Monsters?
I'm looking to see real quick if there's anything. We should probably mention, or I guess I want to mention, The Tempest, which is Julie Taymor's new movie. Adaptation of the Shakespeare play, The Tempest. It has Helen Mirren as the Prospero character, who I think we last saw incarnated on film by Sir John Gielgud in the movie Without Clothes, Prospero's books.
Yeah, unless you count the made-for-TV version with Peter Fonda set in Louisiana.
I didn't see. We'll go to Prospero's books then.
I'm actually looking forward to The Tempest simply because I liked her last Shakespeare film, Titus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even though I think, although I don't really care that much for Frida, and I think Across the Universe is awful.
Mm.
I hate that film with a passion.
And there's also The King's Speech, which is with Colin Firth and Jeffrey Rush as, George
the something.
Yeah.
That's his official George title, George the something.
He's a,
one of George the number.
One of the 20th century George Kings, basically, who has this trouble speaking publicly, basically, and Jeffrey Rush is a speech therapist who helps him out. And it sounds kind of lame, but apparently it's pretty good. It's directed by the guy who did The Damned United, which was a film last year that I loved. And also he directed the John Adams miniseries. And supposedly it's got that quality like the Peter Morgan scripts, you know, mm-hmm. like The Queen and The Deal and the Martin Sheen as Tony Blair kind of movie.
Right.
So I'm looking forward to that one for that reason. You know.
Which, as an aside, there was a really amusing story today. Mm-hmm. Where Peter Morgan is now claiming that Tony Blair actually plagiarized him. Because in Tony Blair's autobiography, he basically recounts a scene from The Queen with the dialogue that Peter Morgan wrote
and made
for
up
him and made
had,
up.
Yeah.
And now Tony Blair has sort of appropriated it.
Peter Morgan's like, okay, statement. Well, there's three things happen here. Either A, I'm psychic.
Yeah. So I thought that was a pretty amusing story.
Yeah. So, well, I don't know if we're going to do video picks this week. But I did want to mention, in kind of a little tangent, we were talking about kind of the period epic type thing, mm-hmm. and we're not getting much of one this year in movies, but I've seen some of the first episodes of HBO's Boardwalk Empire, which is this set in 1920 in Atlantic City, starring Steve Buscemi, and it's co-created by Martin Scorsese and Terrence Winter, one of the writers of The Sopranos. I believe he wrote the second most number of Sopranos episodes, next to David Chase.
And Scorsese directed the pilot.
Scorsese directed the pilot, yeah. And it delivers the goods.
Nice.
I mean, it's as good as you kind of hope. It lives up to the promise of all those people behind it.
That's crazy.
I don't want to oversell it because there are things you can pick at it about it. But it's like the kind of thing that you want from it, you know. And I'm really excited about it. I can't wait to see the next ones that I see, you know.
Oh, that's
and it's
great.
So it's really cool. But it's kind of disappointing that, you know, you have to look to like something like HBO for something with content like this, you know.
Well, to refer to another article, A.O. Scott just published an article yesterday, I think, that's called "Are Films Bad or Is TV Just Better?"
Yeah.
And it's basically asking, you know, is sort of TV taking over the spot that movies once occupied? Mm-hmm. You know, is there more cultural discussion and more sort of in-depth thematic discussion mm-hmm. going on about TV than there is about movies?
I think
there's very much a point to be made there, because you've got, you know, the way that people go into these really in-depth recaps of shows.
Yeah.
You know, every week as the shows are run, you're getting this you know, critical analysis from quite a number of corners of the internet, and some of which is very astute and on point, and not just recapping, but sort of thematically delving into what's really happening.
Mm-hmm. I haven't read his article, but I mean, I would say just from that thesis, I wouldn't say like films have necessarily done anything wrong. I think if anything, TV's just had more freedom to do things right. You know, that to just give, you know, not it used to be just HBO, but now like AMC and other, you know, networks are giving their shows more freedom to tell richer stories and weave, you know, these just greater tapestries that really suck viewers in and have, you know, thoughtful themes.
Yeah. And there probably would have been, if there had been the internet in the 80s, there probably would have been recaps of like Hill Street Blues or Saint Elsewhere.
Yeah. It's not like TV was never good until 5 years ago.
Yeah. But I think that something about the serialization of TV lends itself to that kind of analysis. Whereas the film, it's like, you know, it'd be one film and you see the film and you kind of move on. So it's like, there's not this kind of engine to like, oh, let's take apart this thing more and dig into these things in the same way as the TV shows.
Yeah. Well, and even just something like, you know, for movies, Once Upon a Time, October would have been kind of horror movie season because of Halloween. Mm-hmm. It's an obvious anchor for horror movies. And this year we've got, you know, okay, so we've got Monsters, potentially a sort of horror-ish monster movie. Mm-hmm. We've got Let Me In, which is kind of a horror movie, but kind of not. But then we've got, what, Saw 3D? Mm-hmm. I could give a shit. Paranormal Activity 2. Meanwhile, over on AMC on Halloween night, we have the premiere of The Walking Dead, directed by Frank Darabont, and that looks awesome.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm super excited for that.
Yeah,
and
there's a 4.5-minute trailer of that that looks very faithful to the original graphic novel.
Shot in Atlanta.
And it also looks awesome, too. You know, like the faithful thing is almost kind of a side benefit.
And actually, that's a good place to plug. I'm not sure how they're going to pull this this off, but so some of the people that worked on makeup for The Walking Dead mm-hmm. are doing a thing in Atlanta that is called God, I got to look up the title, but it's basically like a zombie survival experience. It's mm-hmm. kind of a haunted house, and it's kind of an adventure tour sort of thing. It's going to be set up off of Moreland. If you go south past the Starlight Drive-In, mm-hmm. Just cross 285, and right after you cross 285, you can make a right, and you can go to what was set up as kind of it's a disused truck stop mm-hmm. that's got a motel and some other another building or so mm-hmm. there, and it was sort of set up as this really awesome looking paintball range, but it's being reconfigured as the Atlanta zombie experience mm-hmm. and you're going to be able to go down there and basically be led around by this military type guy and you're going to be led through a zombie attack and they're going to have people, you know, made up as zombies obviously I was down there.
There won't be real zombies. I want my money back.
There won't be real zombies. I was down there for a video shoot about a week and a half ago, and I was talking to the guys who were putting it together, and they were like, yeah, you know, for each group, we're going to stage a car crash that's mm-hmm. going to be right there. You're going to rob a convenience store. Mm-hmm. You're going to it's like you're going to be led. Basically, if you played the game Left 4 Dead, it's mm-hmm. like awesome. Live action mm-hmm. Left 4 Dead.
Yeah.
And usually that sort of thing, I'm kind of like, whatever. This sounds so awesome.
Holy it's crap. Like,
yeah.
When does this thing start happening?
As far as I understand it, it's October 1st.
I know what I'm doing October 1st.
But I'm not positive. So it's AtlantaZombieApocalypse.com. Mm-hmm. So it's the Atlanta Zombie Apocalypse, and that's the website as well. And as the website says, the Atlanta Zombie Apocalypse is an immersive Halloween attraction like nothing seen or experienced before. This isn't a leisurely stroll through a haunted house. This will feel like you're in a Hollywood movie, running in and out of buildings, up and down stairs, and covering a lot of ground as you flee from the undead who all want to eat your brains. Mm-hmm. 90,000 square feet of terror.
Yeah. And how can movies compete with that?
Exactly. Yeah. Screw TV. Screw The Walking Dead.
I want to do things. Yeah.
Exactly. So if they pull this off, it could be awesome. Mm-hmm. So keep your eyes out for that. It's supposedly hitting in October. Yeah.
All right. So, okay. I just wanted to mention that Boardwalk Empire debuts on September 19th, which is why I mentioned it on the show.
Yeah.
And I think that's everything we wanted to cover. So, anyway, once again, this is Kurt Holman with Creative Loafing.
I'm Matt Goldberg with Collider.com. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/Matt Goldberg.
And I'm Russ Fisher from slashfilm.com. And I'm on Twitter at twitter.com/RussFisher, FISCHER, all one word.
And thanks again to Alejandro Leal for producing the show.
Thank you, Alejandro.
And thank you for listening all the way through to the end.